Hello, I'm Lynn Ormudu. Welcome to Health Chat. The coronavirus affects people differently. Some people have no symptoms at all, but the virus can be a death sentence for others. While most people with COVID-19 recover and return to normal health, experts say some patients have symptoms that can last for weeks or even months after recovery from acute illness. On the program today, we will take a look at post-COVID syndrome with our guest, Dr. Angelo Carfi, medical doctor at the Gemelli Hospital in Rome, Italy. But first, being intubated and laying on a bed for weeks without properly moving, eating or speaking has left many scarred. More with VOA's Mariama Diallo on some lasting effects from the coronavirus, including fatigue, shortness of breath, muscle pain, headaches, poor balance, and memory loss.
Many people who had serious cases of COVID-19 are dealing with its long-term effects months after leaving the hospital. In Barcelona, 56-year-old Pablo Aguilar is one of them. He spent 3 months at the hospital, 1 month in the ICU. It's been 5 months since he left the hospital.
The truth is, I am surprised because I thought that at this point I would be walking better. The long-term effects that have remained, they are tremendous. I get tired. I have become afraid of going out in the street alone. I have a small dog. Taking the dog out, I considered a big responsibility. I don't care.
Aguilar is part of a group of COVID-19 survivors participating in a rehabilitation program in a Barcelona public hospital. Activities include exercises to strengthen muscle, improve balance, and aerobic capacity. Another participant, Eulalia Canella, a mother of two and a 49-year-old nurse, got infected while taking care of virus patients. She was never hospitalized but suffered from pneumonia and was bedridden at home for a month. In the summer, she thought she was getting better but noticed new symptoms popping up: hair loss, numbness in the hands, and muscle pain. Not a day goes by without a headache, she says. Recently, doctors discovered her lungs weren't working properly, hence affecting her kidneys.
Your active time reduces itself to 3 or 4 hours a day. The rest of the time you must be on the sofa stretched out or resting. Dinner time comes and you must tell your kids, make yourself whatever you can, because mother cannot get up from the sofa.
Dr. Esther Marker oversees the rehabilitation programs Canella is part of. She also had COVID-19 in the spring, but unlike her patients, recovered quickly and is now back at work.
We have two big groups of patients who are untrained from being in the ICU, for example, who get tired and have muscular pain and can feel like they're running out of breath even when they're resting. And then you have another profile of patients who have difficulty swallowing or difficulty speaking.
Marco estimates some 15 to 20% of COVID-19 patients who were hospitalized will end up needing serious rehabilitation. Spain has the sixth highest number of coronavirus cases in the world, with more than 1.5 million people infected since the beginning of the pandemic. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Nearly a year into the global coronavirus pandemic, doctors are monitoring patients they call COVID long haulers, people who still suffer from symptoms months after they recovered from the immediate effect of the virus. Anna Nelson has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Michael Reagan got infected with COVID-19 in the early spring of 2020. By May, he thought the worst was over. But in June, he was still coughing blood, had difficulty breathing, his hands were trembling, he would faint from time to time, and his heart was racing. What is more, he never regained his sense of taste and smell.
I smell phantom smells, like I smell something burning at all times. I smell smoke. And often, you know, in the night, I'll wake up and in my pajamas, I'll run into the apartment and I'll look to see if something is burning, and it's not, it's me.
Reagan is what doctors are calling a COVID long hauler, a person who has never recovered from some of the worst effects of COVID-19. And he's not alone. There are thousands of others suffering from the same syndrome. Reagan and a group of other long haulers started an online group and even held a Zoom meeting with a representative of the WHO.
One of the specific factors are that people have relapses, so you seem to get better and then you get worse. Your symptoms come back, you have new symptoms appearing at random times.
Today, scientists agree that COVID-19 is a systemic disease. It affects various human organs, including the brain and nervous system. Recent research published by neurologist Igor Kuralnik found that about a third of patients who survived COVID developed alterations of brain function. Symptoms included feelings of disorientation to coma. And that is true for patients with light forms of COVID or even those who didn't have any symptoms.
It takes some time for people to go over the first minor respiratory presentation, then have a free interval out of, you know, without any symptoms, and then present those lingering neurologic manifestations.
The problem of long haulers is growing, and special clinics are starting to open across the U.S. to specifically help such people. At a Seattle clinic, Amy Compton Phillips, the doctor who treated the first COVID patient in the U.S., is trying to learn more about long haulers.
We do have a large study going on now with citizen scientists trying to understand, what are people's symptoms and what are they experiencing, starting from the time of their diagnosis through to really see what, if we can figure out, is it 35% that's long haul? Is it 10%? Is it 75? You know, I don't know. But we're trying very hard to learn.
And Michael Reagan hopes they have some answers soon. Like many long haulers, he still can't work. The most he can do is go for a short walk with his dog. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
A research published this year by Italian experts in the medical journal JAMA sheds a light on persistent symptoms in patients after acute COVID-19. I spoke with Angelo Carfi, one of the authors of the study and medical doctor at the Gemelli Hospital in Rome. He tells us more.
Dr. Angelo Carfi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
You did a research early on this phenomenon of post-COVID syndrome, where we're looking at patients that have COVID-19 developing symptoms later on. Can you kind of give us a sense of what you have observed?
Okay. I want to deliver two main messages. The very first one is for those who already had COVID, and that the majority, the message is this: the majority of people we enrolled in our study fully recovered from COVID-19. So this is the best part. And for those who instead disregard the importance and the risks associated with COVID-19, I want to say that unfortunately, the proportion of people who still present symptoms after recovery is unexpectedly high, at least in the population we have seen in our hospital. And this is a problem. There is a problem on that, and we should not discard or take it as not important. So recovery and convalescence from COVID-19 is important, and we should care about it.
So, Dr. Angelo, what do we see in terms of the types of symptoms that you have observed? Can you walk us through some of the symptoms that you've seen?
We are seeing at this moment patients in the between 3 to 4 months since the beginning of their symptoms. And when we see them, they a certain proportion still present with fatigue and shortness of breath and pain. These are three main symptoms we are observing. And the pain is not well-defined pain in the muscles, joints, or while breathing in the chest. And the proportion is quite high, is unexpectedly high. So a person in two could present with fatigue. and which is this extremely easy exhaustion while you exercise, or a feeling of low energy. And the respiratory symptoms are pretty straightforward, since the disease, the COVID-19, is mainly pneumonia, and so this is not unexpected, actually. But for the fatigue or the pain or persistent gastrointestinal symptoms or anosmia, this is quite surprising. And then, aside of this, there's also the so-called COVID fog, foggy brain, which is another possibly persistent symptom we are researching on.
And what is COVID fog brain?
So the people says that they have hard times to focus attention, or remove the distracting thoughts or distracting stimuli, or they could have hard times also to remember. The so-called working memory is the memory you use in everyday tasks. So you get into the room and say, well, what should I do here, and go back and forth, and people can feel quite bad about this sort of neurological symptoms. And also the COVID fog could be sustained also by sleep disturbances, which people still have a lot of time after COVID-19.
We are almost a year on now. It's been more than 9 months. What do we know in terms of the long-term effect of these post-COVID syndrome?
So the so-called natural history of the disease and the recovery from this disease is still unknown, and we should research actively in this field. And since we don't know the natural history, we are not able yet to differentiate who's gonna have persistent or long symptoms or who's not. And we actually don't even know if these symptoms are persistent, as we call it, or it's long COVID, or permanent symptoms. So we hope they are persistent, and we could do a lot to gain back people their previous functionality and previous fitness, but we are still not able to really say something based on data.
When people are exhibiting post-COVID syndrome, are they contagious with the disease? Can they transmit it to others, or can they develop the disease again?
This is in the big question mark. So we actually don't know who is contagious now. And infectivologists are very active in this kind of research. And we don't know if during the convalescence the virus is able to reactivate or to be persistently reproducing in the body, and or is hiding somewhere in the body and do it something. So we are not able to make these statements right now. It's in the hypothesis. Or maybe we are just seeing what is a long tissue recovery phase, which could take long. Or maybe we could even be seeing some sort of a long tail of a very bad experience that the patients had. Because all these symptoms are not specific at all. So fatigue is, or shortness of breath are not very specific for something. And these people really had a bad experience, or in the hospital, or in the house. They were isolated for a long time, bedridden, and this could leave some signs in the person, in the behavior, and in the well-being.
So is there something people can do to reduce their chances of developing post-COVID syndrome?
Yeah, we are unfortunately in this phase. So we in our clinic, we invite people to a physical training with trainers, and also a diet. We suggest a diet. And we are receiving very good feedback from these training groups, because people is a chance to break the cage. So you go out from your house, you meet other people who had the same experience, and you are able to move, to train, to increase the you get back your body and the fitness. And this helps really a lot. Or we could suggest that if there's some vitamins which are low, we suggest to supplement these vitamins and have a healthy diet. But more than that, we are unable to offer at this very moment.
So when you talk about a healthy diet, can you just give us an idea of what you tell people to eat or not to eat?
So we basically is with a diet with the right amount of proteins, basically, because the bedridness, the fact of being bedridden is heavily affecting the muscle fitness. And then a diet full of antioxidants and vegetables and vitamins, which can help to reduce the burden of these cytokines, which are all around the body during the acute infection and also during the recovery.
What is the main takeaway of your study?
Yeah, probably what I said before, and it's that, first of all, there is a long COVID syndrome. It's true. It's there. It's not just a few people telling this story. It's in the data. So it's a real problem. And doctor and health system should take care of this problem, first of all. And the second message is let's try to avoid to get COVID, because we don't know how to prevent these persistent symptoms. So let's wear a mask, let's behave correctly, and do things in the right way until we get all vaccinated and are protected with the herd immunity and can get back to the usual life.
And finally, Dr. Angelo, when is someone considered to have recovered from COVID, which determines that they have long-term symptoms?
There's not an exact point. There is a moment during the course of illness where you are you are not isolated anymore. So this is the only point we have, so people can get back to their lives and can go around. But other than that, we don't have a moment when these things really is considered to be over, other than the feeling of the own person, the well-being of the person. So when they say, "Okay, I'm back," they are recovered. Otherwise, they're not.
Dr. Angelo Carfi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Lenore, for inviting me.
It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Join
Ongoing issues in the news, moderator Michael Williams and a panel of Washington experts as they analyze the top news stories of the week, including U.S. Congress is set to act on a $900 billion COVID-19 relief package to businesses, individuals, and resources for vaccines. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Vaccinations against the dreaded COVID-19 have started in the United States after several million doses were made available. Several frontline health workers who have been prioritized to take the vaccine are sharing their experiences and trying to demystify fears of the vaccine's effects. New York-based Zimbabwean emergency room doctor Mona Lisa Muchatuta, who recovered from COVID-19, said she decided to take the vaccine because of what she knows about the deadly virus. Dr. Muchatuta tells Marvelous Mlanga Nyahuye of VOA's Zimbabwe service that her decision to take the vaccine was a no-brainer.
So I chose to take the vaccine because the way the pandemic went in the spring of 2020 was disastrous, extremely emotional. I mean, I've just never experienced anything like that in my life or career, and I don't think a lot of people understand. And so, you know, the way that I fear COVID, I had COVID and recovered, but still, just still seeing just the number, the vast number of deaths that we've had, the way even now post like the initial wave, the amount of effect that it's had on people, loss of jobs, loss of life, loss of like connections. There's a lot of like downstream effects of COVID outside of just death and illness. And I think for me, it was a no-brainer. Like, there's a vaccine that's 95% successful, has very, very minimal known side effects, versus an illness that, you know, you don't know if when you get it, you are going to be the one that's going to die. You don't know if me just even being exposed to it is going to kill my family, because they have, you know, all the risk factors for bad COVID reactions. So I know COVID kills, I know COVID hurts, versus something that I know can prevent me. It was a no-brainer.
Which vaccine did you take, and which one do you see likely to be taken to Africa to benefit countries like Zimbabwe?
The vaccine that I took is the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. That's the mRNA one. Another one that's kind of coming in the pipeline is Moderna. It's being currently reviewed right now, so we'll see if that's going to come through. The one that will likely go, and mostly just saying likely based on just proximity, is the AstraZeneca one that was developed at Oxford, mostly because of proximity. A lot of the times, a lot of the medications that are developed within the UK are the ones that go to them, just being a UK colony, but also just because, and that one was developed from an adenovirus and not mRNA. One, two, the Moderna and the Pfizer ones are a little bit more expensive to have, like very specific storage requirements that we think will make it very difficult for it to be brought to Africa. And also the AstraZeneca one also had a broader pool of patient types that were researched upon, i.e. they had some patients in South Africa, some patients in Brazil, as well as in the UK, whereas the Pfizer one was mostly here in the United States. Not that it matters, but I expect the AstraZeneca one is the likely one to come to Africa.
What are the benefits of having this vaccine? A lot of people, there are so many myths out there about this COVID-19 vaccine.
Making decisions based on myths is like the most dangerous thing that any human being can do for yourself, especially when we're faced in this pandemic that has been killing people. So, you know, some of the myths that I've heard is that, oh, it was rushed. Let's just break this down. We're in 2020. We're in a pandemic, and, you know, we begged and we cried for a vaccine, our leaders decided that let's put all the money into this. Let's get the brightest minds in the world to work on this. And the scientists did their job. You know, they came up and they came through and they brought us this vaccine. And I think, you know, constantly looking for excuses to say, oh, it's too fast. It's not too fast. They did the research. We have the side effect profiles. We have the adverse effects. You know, I think people just need to just acknowledge that this is an emotional decision for them and kind of, you know, lean into what's emotional about it. I think there's a lot of distrust, especially in the Black and minority communities, based on like previous things that happened in the past with vaccinations and all of these things. But, you know, there's a lot of things that I feel like people just need to spend a little bit more time researching, and research is not going on social media and following your favorite artist or following your favorite non-medical person, non-research-oriented person that can interpret the data. So spend some time for yourself talk to your doctor. Like, I think that's the best way, honestly.
Zimbabwean Dr. Monalisa Muchatuta of the State University of New York, speaking with Marvelous Mlanganga Nyahuye of VOA's Zimbabwe service. Now, the UN Refugee Agency is appealing for $455 million to help keep refugees and displaced people safe and protected from the many uncertainties of the COVID-19 pandemic. The UNHCR says millions of refugees, displaced and stateless people are particularly vulnerable to loss of jobs and livelihoods. They are open to exploitation and often lack the basic health, sanitary and other tools they need to protect themselves from the coronavirus. Lisa Schlein has the story.
Everybody is vulnerable to infection from the coronavirus, but refugees, displaced and stateless people are among those most at risk of becoming ill and dying from the virus. Monitoring carried out by the UN Refugee Agency in 13 countries since the onset of the pandemic finds 74% of these vulnerable groups are able to meet less than half of their basic needs. This is a 21% increase over pre-pandemic days in 2019. And it notes more than 80% have to resort to negative coping mechanisms to survive, including selling their belongings, becoming sex workers, and resorting to child labor. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says urban refugees rely on a daily wage to pay for essentials, but jobs and livelihoods have been crushed by COVID-19 lockdowns.
In many locations, they have been just wiped out as markets close down, as the scope for daily work with restriction goes down. So those desperate refugees need cash. Use of cash to help meet basic needs and facilities to access to services, protection of incomes and livelihoods.
Baluch says refugees are unable to practice social distancing in overcrowded displacement camps. So he says more emphasis there will be placed on providing water, soap, and other essential tools to keep people safe.
If you look at the picture in Sudan, Eastern Sudan, where refugees from Ethiopia are recently arriving, it's a big challenge. We have more than 51,000 refugees that have arrived in recent weeks, scattered in the border areas. It's also a challenge and an effort to make sure that they are safe from the COVID pandemic as well as their host communities.
Money can go just so far to help people who have fallen into conditions of extreme hardship. But the UN Refugee Agency says it can improve many lives, and it plans to focus on measures it deems most beneficial. Beyond basic needs, the UNHCR says funds from the appeal will be used to prevent gender-based violence, to protect people from exploitation, and to provide mental health and psychological counseling. The agency is making education a priority and plans to reopen safe schools. Where that is not possible, it says it will invest in online and offline distance education. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's it for this edition of Health Chat. We thank our guest, Dr. Angelo Carfi, with the Gemelli Hospital in Rome, Italy. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat, and let's keep the conversation going and strive to make every day a healthy day.